Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly Higher Education Report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us how to write a great college paper. Many non-native English speakers have no idea what professors in the U.S. expect from a college paper. After you hear Pete's report, you will. Then you will hear words and their stories. One of our most popular programs. This week, Anna Mateo will bring us part two of her three-part report on the many American English expressions using the word ice. And as we do every Sunday, we will present the making of a nation. Today, we will tell you about the space race. It began with Sputnik and ended with an American on the moon. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So let's get started. Here's higher education correspondent Pete Musto.
Strong writing is one of the most important skills for any college student. Many non-native English speakers have no idea what professors in the U.S. expect from a college paper. A college paper is a piece of writing that can be as long as 20 or more pages. Even native English-speaking college students struggle with how to succeed with such a difficult responsibility. Deborah DeSasso is the Writing Resource Coordinator at the University of the District of Columbia. DeSasso helps students reach the level of writing that college professors expect. She says college writing is very different from what many students experience earlier in their education.
Usually, a lot of high schools stress a lot of creative type writing, and so you can pretty much say what you want. Meaning is what you say it is. When you get to college, you need to be able to formulate an argument and then defend it. Using credible sources.
A credible source provides verifiable information from experts. This includes books, interviews, newspapers, or studies. Most U.S. high schools teach students how to write five-paragraph essays. Students are often unprepared for the amount of research they have to do for a college paper. Nabila Hijazi is one of the assistant directors of the University of Maryland Writing Center. Hijazi is also an international student from Syria in the second year of her PhD program in English Studies. She says the language barrier is not the biggest problem for students whose first language is not English.
Sometimes I see international students who know English grammar more than the native or the U.S. born students, but maybe they do not know about the writing system that we have here in terms of organization, thesis, transition. They do not know how to connect sentences, how to redirect.
In a traditional paper, The first paragraph often contains the thesis statement. This statement is a one-sentence summary of the paper's main argument. The first paragraph of a college paper, or any paper, is usually the most challenging. The first paragraph is also the most important because it will guide the structure and show the voice of the entire paper. But not every type of writing is the same. There are also case studies and field reports in addition to traditional papers. DeSasso says that the best option for a student who wants to improve their writing is to read.
One professor told me, you write something in your head before you write it on paper. Until you learn to imagine when you read, you'll never be able to imagine something that you have to write before you have to write it.
Reading examples of the type of paper your professor expects you to write can be very helpful. Professors sometimes provide examples. You can also search the internet for examples of papers about similar topics. But you should never copy another person's work. Professors will find out if the work is copied, and you will get in a lot of trouble. Hijazi adds that writing a paper takes time. Students should let other students read their work and listen to criticism.
I try to teach them that the first draft is not the final draft. They need to be open to the idea that writing is a process. They have to go through different steps, different revisions.
I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Now, here's Anna Mateo.
This week, we continue learning about cold weather expressions with the story, Mystery at the Ice Castle Inn. In the first part of our story, we met the characters. Madeline, the teacher. Vincent, the athlete. Sylvia, the actress. And Major Jack, the ex-military man. They have all traveled to the Ice Castle Inn. This mountain inn is a popular vacation spot for bird watchers. However, a cold snap has blown through the mountains, snowing them in. This is an extreme and unexpected drop in temperature, so no one is prepared. They have been trapped inside the castle for several days. When people are stuck inside together with nothing to do, they naturally begin talking about themselves. Very quickly, small facts about a person snowball into a bigger picture of them. What this means is that these little facts collect more little facts, like a snowball collecting more snow as it rolls downhill. Soon it becomes a big ball of facts, rolling quickly down the hill, threatening to destroy everything in its path. But I am getting ahead of myself. One of these small facts is this. No one here is actually interested in birds. Our four travelers gather inside by the fireplace. The inn's housekeeper puts a log into the fire. The group does not notice her as she pours more hot cocoa into their empty mugs. You see, they are the kind of people who never really notice the servants. No one is talking. The four guests have avoided each other for several days. But now they are forced together by the warmth of the only working fireplace and the promise of hot cocoa. After all, the inn is quite cold and uncomfortable. Only candles light the rooms. The rugs are so thin that the stone floor underneath shows. Some of the windows are cracked, letting the winter storm blow right through. The castle looks the same way it did 100 years ago. It is a place frozen in time. Finally, Sylvia, the actress, breaks the ice by talking about the winter storm raging outside. Talking about the weather is a common icebreaker that can bring strangers together. It gives them something to talk about. This cold snap is lasting a long time. When will we be able to leave? Sylvia says this to no one in particular. But the teacher, Madeline, responds, "Yes, when can we leave? I am tired of sitting around in this cold, drafty castle." "I have an idea," Vincent, the handsome athlete, says to the young teacher. "Why don't you join me for a walk in the castle?" Madeline stares at him with her cold green eyes and says, "That will happen when hell freezes over." At that, the actress Sylvia laughs out loud. Well, that is a much better way of saying, absolutely not. Vincent realizes that he is now on thin ice with both women. He is not really in danger. Rather, he is now on very uncertain terms with them. The room suddenly drops a couple more degrees, and not from the weather. Major Jack feels sorry for Vincent after the women freeze him out or make him feel unwelcome. So the military man offers him a cigarette. Vincent shakes his head no. He says he quit cold turkey last year. The major says he admires the athlete's accomplishment. He adds that he has never been able to quit smoking all at once. "Well, perhaps you don't have the mental strength that I do," Vincent says. Major Jack regrets trying to help such a cold-hearted man. He turns his attention to Sylvia. He tells her that he likes her voice very much. Most women would melt at his words, but for Sylvia, they cut no ice. His words have no effect. Her once friendly voice turns to ice as she says, "What shall I do next? Sing for you?" He shudders, not from the temperature of the room, but from her icy stare. He thinks to himself that the attractive actress can certainly be an ice queen when she wants to be. At this point, it is fair to say that the conversations among the group are not going well. Outside, the temperature is dropping. Everything is frozen solid. Inside, the entire inn is in a different kind of deep freeze. Everyone sits in silence. They stare at the fire as it makes crackling noises in the fireplace. Next to it, only a few logs of wood remain. This is when the very quiet housekeeper breaks the stone-cold silence. She straightens her back, takes off her apron, and pushes her gray hair back into place. "If I may have your attention," she says to the group. Her voice cuts through the coldness that hangs in the air. "The owner of the inn has planned an interesting game for you, our special guests, to play." Vincent throws cold water on the idea. He laughs and says coldly, "I'm not a child. I don't play games." "You may want to change your mind, young man. This game is a kind of treasure hunt," the housekeeper says. She is standing in front of the group and no longer seems like just a servant. She now has control of the room. When they hear the word treasure, they pay close attention to the housekeeper for the first time since their arrival. She places a large wooden box on the table. It is labeled Treasure Hunt. She explains, "In this box are four envelopes marked with each person's name. In the envelope are clues. If you follow the clues correctly, you will find your treasure." They all agree to play. They are thinking that finding some cold hard cash would be a really nice treasure. They pick their envelopes and read the clues carefully. Then each person travels through the empty hallways and rooms of the otherwise deserted castle. 3 hours later, the sun sinks behind the cold mountains. The four treasure seekers return to the fireplace. The housekeeper is waiting. She motions with her hand for them to sit by the fire. And one by one, she asks them to reveal their treasure. Madeline is first. "My treasure is a framed termination letter? I don't understand. Am I being fired for something?" The calm in her eyes is gone. And for the first time, she is nervous. Vincent is not confused or nervous. He is simply angry. "My treasure is a bride's white wedding veil." He throws the thin white piece of fabric into the air. Major Jack takes out what he found, a military medal. He reads the writing on the front, "For brave service in battle." He looks as if he has seen a ghost. Sylvia's treasure is a pink baby's rattle. With a haunted look on her face, she shakes it slowly and sadly. Confusion and tension fill the room. Finally, Sylvia, who is standing by the fire as if she were on stage, says what everyone is thinking. "Okay, this is too much, and it isn't funny. Why are we here? And who is teasing us with these so-called treasures?" The housekeeper begins to speak, but suddenly she stops. A terrible sound, part human, part animal, howling from a room above them, freezes their blood cold. And that is where we will leave part two of our story. Join us next week for the exciting conclusion of Mystery at the Ice Castle Inn on Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now, we present The Making of a Nation with Steve Ember.
On a cold October day in 1957, the Soviet Union launched a small satellite into orbit around the Earth. Radio Moscow made the announcement.
"The first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
Sputnik was an important propaganda victory for the Soviets in the Cold War with the United States. Many people believed the nation that controlled space could win any war. The Soviets took the first step by creating Sputnik. This satellite was about the size of a basketball. It got its power from a rocket. It orbited Earth for 3 months. Within weeks, the Soviets launched another satellite into Earth orbit, Sputnik 2. It was much bigger and heavier than Sputnik 1. It also carried a passenger, a dog named Laika. The United States joined the space race about 3 months later. It launched a satellite from Cape Canaveral in the southeastern state of Florida. The satellite was called Explorer 1. It weighed about 14 kilograms. Explorer 1 went into a higher orbit than either Sputnik, and its instruments made an important discovery. They found an area of radiation about 960 kilometers above Earth. The next major space victory belonged to the Soviets. They sent the first man into space. In April 1961, cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin was launched in the vehicle known as Vostok. He remained in space for less than 2 hours. he landed safely by parachute near a village in Russia. Less than a month later, the United States sent its first astronaut into space. He was Alan Shepard. Shepard remained in space only about 15 minutes. He did not go into Earth orbit. That flight came in February 1962 with John Glenn. By 1965, the United States and the Soviet Union were experimenting to see if humans could survive outside a spacecraft. In March, Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov became the first person to do so. A strong tether connected Leonov to the spacecraft. The tether gave him oxygen to breathe, and it permitted him to float freely at the other end. After about 10 minutes, Leonov had to return to the spacecraft. He said he regretted the decision. He was having such a good time. A little more than 2 months later, an American would walk outside his spacecraft. Astronaut Edward White had a kind of rocket gun. This gave him some control of his movements in space. Like Leonov, White was sorry when he had to return to his spacecraft. Later that year, 1965, the United States tried to have one spacecraft get very close to another spacecraft while in orbit. This was the first step in getting spacecraft to link or dock together. Docking would be necessary to land men on the moon. The plan called for a Gemini spacecraft carrying two astronauts to get close to an unmanned satellite. The attempt failed. The target satellite exploded as it separated from its main rocket. America's space agency decided to move forward. It would launch the next in its Gemini series. Then someone had an idea. Why not launch both Geminis? The second one could chase the first one instead of a satellite. Again, things did not go as planned. It took two tries to launch the second Gemini. By that time, the first one had been in orbit about 11 days. Time was running out. The astronauts on the second Gemini moved their spacecraft into higher orbits. They got closer and closer to the Gemini ahead of them. They needed to get within 600 meters to be considered successful. After all the problems on the ground, the events in space went smoothly. The two spacecraft got within 1/3 of a meter of each other. The astronauts had made the operation seem easy. In January 1959, the Soviets launched a series of unmanned lunar rockets. The third of these flights took pictures of the far side of the moon. This was the side no one on Earth had ever seen. The United States planned to explore the moon with its unmanned Ranger spacecraft. There were a number of failures before Ranger 7 took pictures of the moon. These pictures were made from a distance. The world did not get pictures from the surface of the moon until the Soviet Luna 9 landed there in February 1966. For the next few years, both the United States and the Soviet Union continued their exploration of the moon. Yet the question remained, which one would be the first to put a man there? In December 1968, the United States launched Apollo 8 with three astronauts. The flight proved that a spacecraft could orbit the moon and return to Earth safely. The Apollo 9 spacecraft had two vehicles. One was the command module. It could orbit the moon, but could not land on it. The other was the lunar module. On a flight to the moon, it would separate from the command module and land on the moon's surface. Apollo 10 astronauts unlinked the lunar module and flew it close to the moon's surface. After those flights, everything was ready.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engines running. Liftoff. We have the liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
On July 16th, 1969, three American astronauts lifted off in Apollo 11. On the 20th, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin entered the lunar module called the Eagle. Michael Collins remained in the command module, the Columbia. The two vehicles separated.
25 feet, guys looking good, down a half.
It was a dangerous time. The Eagle could crash, or it could fall over after it landed. That meant the astronauts would die on the moon.
Forward, drift into the right a little. 30 seconds forward.
Millions of people watched on television or listened on the radio. They waited for Armstrong's message.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The Eagle has landed. Then they waited again. It took the astronauts more than 3 hours to complete the preparations needed to leave the lunar module. Finally, the door opened. Neil Armstrong climbed down first. He put one foot on the moon, then the other foot, and then came his words from so far away.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Man on the moon. Oh, boy. Boy.
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute.
CBS television newsman Walter Cronkite shared the excitement that he and so many people felt as man first walked on the surface of the moon. Later, Cronkite would remember the historical significance of that moment in 1969.
It was hard, I think, to imagine our emotions at the moment. It really was something that had to grip you. It was as if you could have stood at the dock and waved goodbye to Columbus. You knew darn good and well that this was the real history in the making.
Armstrong walked around. Soon, Aldrin joined him.
They're setting up the flag now.
The two men placed an American flag on the surface of the moon. They also collected moon rocks and soil. When it was time to leave, they returned to the Eagle and guided it safely away. They reunited with the Columbia and headed for home. The United States had won the race to the moon.
The thing that made this one particularly gripping was that sense of history that if this was successful, this was a date that was going to be in all of the history books from time evermore. I think we sensed that at the time, just sitting there at the Cape and watching that great beast get on its way, that this was it.
This Making of a Nation program was written by David Jarmul, Steve Ember, and Geraldine Watson. It was presented and produced by Steve Ember, and we thank them all. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from The Voice of America.